Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Thursday. It is the 7th of November, 14 minutes past 9 o'clock. Hi. How have you all been?
We made it through day one of the
All right. Good. Good. Trump just checking Riviera. In. Good. Checking in with everybody, making sure you're all well. I first of all want to thank everyone who participated, everyone who helped, everyone who was responsible for yesterday's three-hour broadcast from the Linda in our post-election roundtable special. It was very I think it was good. I mean, it was a great show, and it was do you want Judy on three or four, Mike? Okay. Why don't you try four?
Gotcha.
There you go. Yep, you're good. So I thought it was a great show, and I thank all of you. Obviously, a lot of emotions and a lot of thoughts going through the room, and it was good to capture that, and we were glad that you were all with us. All three of the individuals who are on the panel today were with us yesterday, and I thank them profusely for being with us, not just yesterday, but then to do this really strange thing and come back. So we thank you for that. Whoa, did you just see that, Judy?
Yeah.
Oh, wow, that was like a sprinkler. I was just trying to get the thing up on my the little tab up on my coffee, and it just like started to spit out.
It was jubilant.
Now I also want to mention we heard Pearl Jam coming in, and there is only a good day can bring us to play Pearl Jam. What is the reason? The reason is that our news director, it's his birthday, Ian Pickus, huge Pearl Jam fan, so we play Pearl Jam in his honor today. Good stuff. And making us all a little happier as we get to hear that music coming in and out of the segments this morning. You can see the playlist at wamc.org/roundtable. wamc.org/roundtable. All right, let's get to it. We'll introduce everybody and get started on the issues of the day as the dust starts to settle and we figure out where we're headed here. We go to Teresa Bourgeois, public policy and communications expert. Good morning, Teresa. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning. Doing fine. Interested in the conversation today. Interested in hearing from our listeners about what they're thinking about all of this. So glad to be here. Thank you.
Oh, they'll let you know. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We also welcome the Vice President for Editorial Development of the New York Press Association. Judy Patrick is here. Good morning, Judy. How are you?
I am fine. I can't believe you beat me in, but you did.
I went the Manans.
There
route.
Are a number of backups after that.
Everything from 787, say Waterville, Troy, to I think Kingston is pretty much just stopped.
In every direction it stopped.
I thank all of you for persevering and getting in. And last, certainly not least, we welcome Jim Hendler, Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI. Good morning, Jim. How are you?
I'm doing okay, Joe. You know, it was I did realize that yesterday, you know, what we had assumed would be a discussion of an ongoing thing became a little bit of a wake, and the mistake we made was we should have had it as an Irish wake and just all got drunk and really talked about what we thought.
Well, I will say, and I can tell you this definitively, that that was up for discussion. I will say in the early plannings
Swiping
of the event, we did think of it, but those pesky,
yeah, it might have been a little
those
too
pesky
much.
Permits get in the way, and you just have to, you know, follow the rules. Good morning, all. Welcome. It's very nice to have you with us, and we welcome your thoughts. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. So we start with, as I said, the dust settling and figuring out exactly what the future holds. A lot of a lot of promises, a lot of rhetoric coming out of the campaign. So what exactly does another 4 years of Donald Trump mean for this nation? I do want to mention that President Biden is expected to address the country at 11 this morning, which we will bring you. If I am I'm very good at prognosticating such things, he'll probably be late. So, but we'll plan on running that at 11 o'clock. So somewhere between 11 and 3, it should be, should get to hear the former or hear the current president talk about the former president's return to the White House. And has President Biden invited former President Trump to the White House? All the concession calls that needed to take place took place. The Vice President Harris called former President Trump. President Biden called former President Trump. So all of those calls have taken place, and the we'll talk a little bit about the vice president's concession a little bit later on. But let's talk initially about what we know of Donald Trump's return to the White House. Powered by a historic realignment of the American electorate that upended decades of traditional coalitions as he maintained his majority support among men and white voters without college degrees, but made dramatic inroads with Latinos, first-time voters, and middle and lower-income households, according to preliminary exit polls. In key swing states that decided the election, and I do think it's important, and I'm not rubbing anything in here, I just think it's important that Donald Trump won every swing state, all seven, won every one. Trump cut into traditional Democratic strongholds, urban areas, high-income suburbs in Pennsylvania, black voters in Wisconsin, Arab voters in Michigan. He dramatically expanded his margins in rural counties in Georgia and Wisconsin, easily overcoming Vice President Kamala Harris's advantage in metro areas, including in Atlanta and Milwaukee. It remains unclear whether Trump's win marks a permanent shift in the Republican electorate or one that is unique to him. All told, Trump outperformed his 2020 margins in more than 9 out of 10 counties, where at least 90% of voters have been counted, a stunning rebuke of Trump's, of Democratic leadership over the last 4 years, and an embrace of some of Trump's hardline policies, including a crackdown of undocumented immigrants. But the most dramatic shift came among Hispanic voters, who swung to Trump by 25 points nationally. Harris won a slight majority of these voters nationally, 53% to 45%, according to network exit polling, a dramatic decrease over Joe Biden's 33-point margin in 2020. Among Hispanic men of all ages, Trump saw an 18 percentage point increase in support. This from Whit Ayers, who is a GOP pollster. Donald Trump has recast the Republican Party into a multi-ethnic working-class party that appeals more to those on the lower than the upper end of the income scale. Judy Patrick.
It was indeed an incredible, sweeping victory. There's no ifs, ands, and buts here. He increased his margins, which I was surprised. I mean, I thought he would hold on to his base, but that he wouldn't increase, but he did. And so the Democrats really have to take this time and look at the data. I mean, I think exit polling data offers some insight, but it's not the real data that they're going to need to figure out why the American people do not trust them. I mean, that it comes down to that. They did not trust the Democrats to lead the country, and they need to have a hard self-examination about what happens. And we need to start, going forward, we need to start listening to our neighbors. We need to start being so dismissive of Trump voters. We need to stop grasping onto these, conventional wisdom. Oh, it was the disinformation. People are too stupid to look past the tropes, the racism, the sexism. Certainly there was part of that. But there are people out there, our neighbors who are Trump supporters who are happy today, they're not bad people. I mean, Americans are good people. We need to understand that they went and supported Trump for very valid reasons, and they did not support Trump's. They did not support the Democrats for their own reasons. And we're never going to get past this unless we start being a little bit more open-minded about this.
I agree with you. I also think that it wasn't because of those voters who went out and supported Trump, they were not necessarily supporting some of the more outrageous things that he was saying or some of the more outrageous things that he was doing. They were well aware that that was a show, but they didn't care.
Exactly.
They didn't care. So, go ahead, Jim.
So, you know, I don't want to disagree, Judy, but
You're good now, aren't you?
No. I'm going to agree that the Democratic Party needs to think very hard. But I'm going to agree even more that we really have to look at the data hard, because we're finally getting some of the down ballot numbers that I wanted to look at, and it's really surprising. The Democratic candidates for Senate and for the House, win or lose, did better than Harris in all of the swing states and in several other states. So even though some of these senators who lost, Sherrod Brown and people like that, they actually picked up votes from the Republican Party compared to 2020 and 2016. So I think we're going to have to really look carefully to figure out why at a local stage, Democrats can be competitive. At the national stage, we seem to be losing. Now, you look at the Senate and you say, how can what Jim's saying make sense? And the answer is because you have a whole bunch of red states that are going to vote for two red senators no matter what. So there you can only look at margin differences, right? Because it's going to be a very unlikely thing that some of these people lose. But it really seems like it was the national policies, this concept that the president should be fixing things. My guy is fine. It's the person up top that affects the country. So I don't know. I mean, it's very weird. I think the Democrats are going to have to look very, very carefully and say, why did certain people do better? Why did certain people do worse? And what do we do about it if they're going to stay competitive? And I think by the next election, competitive is going to be fairly challenging, assuming there is a next election, because chances are your Republican nominee is going to be Vance.
See, I don't think we should feed into that hysteria that whether or not there's a next election, there will be a next election. I mean, now let.
I am
right. There will be another election.
Not
I think. I think this is the kind of, again, hype and hysteria that turns people off. And I think it's I talked about my 7-year-old grandson being, in tears. Well, we shouldn't have let our children reach the point where they think that their society is going to collapse because of one election.
Well, so I do also want to agree with some of the things you said, Judy, but disagree strongly with another thing, and this came up yesterday also. So I agree that the Democrats have to really take a deep look at what they're doing. And I think as a broad brush, that they had the Biden administration was historically successful at legislating, and they were consistently unsuccessful at communicating the legislative achievements and what those legislative achievements meant to everyday people's lives. And I think we're going to find that's a big part of this. But where I disagree with you is I think that there is a serious problem, a very deep problem with disinformation. And there are outside forces involved with that as well, and it's a playbook of the Republicans. And but I do think that there is a difference between a problem with disinformation and calling voters stupid and uneducated. I have consistently on this program said that I think it's wrong to call voters uneducated. It's wrong to label them as stupid. You can have very smart voters, but if they are constantly being barraged with messages that are false and misleading, that doesn't make them stupid, but that is a problem. And I think it's troublesome if the lesson that we learn from this is you can lie indiscriminately, you can lie and have those lies be so damaging that they shut down elementary schools because of bomb threats, and that's an okay way to behave. That's a disinformation campaign that was successful for them, but traumatizing and psychologically traumatizing to an entire community, economically difficult for an entire community, and traumatizing well beyond it. I'm talking about as one anecdotal example, Springfield, Ohio.
And 30 seconds, go ahead.
And I think that we can and must talk about the infrastructure now and how people get their information and how disinformation is dangerous, and not have that tagged as denigrating voters. They're two separate things. And conflating those, I think, is equally disturbing and maybe even dangerous. I don't want to say what you said was dangerous, but I think those have to be separated.
You danger.
No,
all right,
I want to be clear. I'm not saying it's
dangerous. We'll take a break, and we'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Thursday morning, the 7th of November. I will say that yesterday we took all of our questions from our studio audience, and we did not take email questions, and now people are catching up. So, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. And we'd love to hear from you. Keep them short and to the point. We can get to as many as possible. And as I said, already a lot in the mailbox, and we'll continue to garner those as we move throughout the morning. Jim.
So I just want to reply to something. You know, Judy, I think a lot of us use the I believe there are people who believe that this is the end of elections
the end of democracy.
The end of democracy, including Trump, who said it. But to be honest, I think a lot of us are really using it as a shortcut for something else, and that's free and fair elections. That's elections where you don't have the states, and particularly the red states, changing the rules fairly arbitrarily. Previously, we had a Supreme Court which was either willing to make federal decisions, or this court, which claimed we're going to let the states make the decisions, except whenever the states appealed up to the Supreme Court, you saw a very mixed set of their responses as to whether the states actually had the power or not. A simple example is Musk giving out the $1 million. There was a state ruling that was in violation of their laws and he should stop. Got appealed, a fast appeal to the Supreme Court, which said the state doesn't get to make that decision. And yet they had previously said all these voting things belong to the state. Same thing with redistricting. The redistricting decisions have not been consistent and have been generally favorable, with one exception, to the Republican Party. So, you know, I think what we're worrying about is just how much that's going to – we already have an almost unfair electoral system in the Electoral College. You add to that new voter suppression rules. You add to that some of the other things that have been claimed that by the states that they're going to do now. And you're – you know, I don't know if it's the death of democracy. I'm not going to go that far. But you are talking about something – which is really reversing a large, you know, hundreds of years, 100-something years of precedent with respect to trying to make voting fairer, right? In New York, we passed Prop 1 so that we would have protection if the Republicans end up with the House and the Senate and President. they can make rules that would override our state constitution, at which point the only appeal is to a Supreme Court that is beholden to them. So I do worry about the national effects. You see, I think part of the problem we see is that things that happen at the national level happen very slowly. They don't affect me for a while, right? So, you know, the Infrastructure Act is a great example. A lot of people are back to work because of that, but they don't realize they're back to work because of that, because it was 2 years ago that the national decision was made. Meanwhile, somebody local in my state made decision X, Y, Z. That affects me immediately. So I see the price of eggs go up, or I see this go up or that go up. You know, I mean, it really is a complicated thing. They believe that inflation can be dealt with this minute, while, you know, some of these other things will take a long time. And
can I add to that, too, and focus on the Justice Department and the Voting Rights Act?
Yep. Sure.
It just, you know, emphasizing the point anecdotally, because now, I mean, you have traditions and norms around the Justice Department and the independence of the Justice Department. In the last Trump administration, he shattered those norms. Those went away, those processes that the Justice Department will be independent. And he has made clear that that's not going to be the case this time. And it's spelled out in Project 2025 and in other things as well. And so what are the implications of that for monitoring, you know, voting rights changes in the states, right? There'll be no check on that. There'll be no check in the courts, and there'll be no check on that in the Justice Department.
So here's what I'm having trouble figuring out, which is, you say he made it very clear, and I agree with you. I think he made it very clear.
Very clear.
And people voted for him. A majority of this country, by a huge margin, voted for him, and thereby we can extrapolate, at least in some cases, agreed that that's where they wanted the country to go.
But I don't think that, and I'm not saying people are not informed. I'm saying the level of complexity of this is that it's, I don't think, you know, you could find 1,000 people who voted on wondering about the security of the Voting Rights Act, right? They voted on the economy, and they voted on the fear, you know, that was stoked around immigration, the othering around immigration, right? And they didn't vote on whether or not you would have their rights would be protected through the Justice Department. That's a really complicated thing. It's not because they're ignorant. It's because it's not something most people think about.
Well, I agree, although...
But it has implications.
You know, you can say a lot of things about Donald Trump, but he doesn't exactly keep things secret. I mean, he
no, I mean,
including
those,
secrets.
Like in those three hour rallies, he was telling people exactly what he planned to do, and the people who, whether they left early or not, said, "Okay, I buy that."
But just like most people don't understand how the infrastructure bill helps in their lives. Right, because it's long-standing and complicated. Most people don't understand the relationship between politicizing the Justice Department and whether or not they're going to stand in a four-hour line to vote in their districts 4 years from now. And there are relationships between those things, but they're complex. And, you know, most people, that's not – they're struggling to get by – pay the heating bill, put food on the table, and make sure that they can carve out some time to get to their kid's softball game, which is what they should be doing, right? But there are these other issues that impact their lives in ways that, you know, they may not realize. But yeah, I totally agree with you. Hillary Clinton said that in 2016. He's telling us what he's going to do. And remember, when he was in office in the Justice Department, he wanted to take it to such an extreme level that the highest ranking people across the board sent back a message saying, if you do this, we will all resign. And that's the only thing that held him back from taking certain actions to politicize a part of the Justice Department the last time. And so what is his fix for that not happening? He's gonna fire all those people and fill all those jobs with his own people so that doesn't happen again.
Judy?
We could spend a lot of time wringing our hands here, but talk to my great-grandmother. She couldn't vote. Talk to the people of color who couldn't vote in the 40s and 50s. Talk to now the discussion is going to be whether or not voter ID is required in every state. New York State does not require voter ID. A lot of people out there in the hinterlands, I will tell you, suggest that maybe we do need voter ID. They don't understand that not everybody in New York City, for example, has a license to produce as a form of identification. So those kinds of issues are going to come up. But I would reiterate that it's an imperfect electoral system. The Electoral College is one thing that's not going to go away. But let's note that Trump won the popular vote this time. I mean, he won. We cannot look past the numbers. And the numbers racked up in, 90% of the counties. He won those. He won among all demographics. I mean, I was trying to find an area where he did gain.
So that means we shouldn't be concerned about the implications of that win. We shouldn't be concerned about if he does what he said he's going to do.
We can certainly be concerned.
So he's said, he's talked about wanting to dismantle the Affordable Care Act for years. So he won, so okay, let him go do that. That's okay.
He's not talking about that now, though, is he? People change their positions on issues.
Of course he's talking about it. In fact, he's talking about bringing in Robert Kennedy.
Well, he is talking about bringing in Robert
Kennedy. And vaccinations. He's talking about he wants to dismantle everything in the IRA. So that's funding for communities to improve their energy efficiency, to bring in solar. And so all that money, although it's interesting that a lot of that money has gone to red states, so maybe he won't do that. But he's pledged to do that. So we shouldn't talk about, what are the implications of that?
We as a society should watch every step he makes going forward from this day on, or and monitor him and watch him. And if we disagree, we should protest. But if you do not pay attention to his margins, the way he won, you are going to be sitting here in 2 years and still wondering, why didn't we win? Why didn't we take back control of the Senate or the House? I think, why are we not listening to these people?
Well, I think an important question is, why do people think that his economic policies are going to help them? And I think that Vice President Harris tried to convey that message, and obviously that message didn't get through. But what he has been clear about for a long time is that he wants to reauthorize. His tax cuts are expiring. He wants to reauthorize those tax cuts. And it's also very clear, the economists say that's not a good idea. And those tax cuts created unprecedented deficits, and they were skewed dramatically to the wealthiest among us. So we know what he's going to do. People did vote for that. He says over and over again that those are helping the average working people. The data, the facts say that's not what happened, and it created huge deficits. Should we not be talking about the reality of that?
Economists came forward and said that the Harris tax proposal, the Harris economic plan would be far better for our economy than the Trump tax proposal.
And that message didn't get through.
That message did not resonate with the people. I mean, you can't get past the $5 loaf of bread. You just can't. And whether or not Trump or whether or not Harris could have ever gotten past that is questionable. It was too much to overcome, too much of that post-pandemic inflation economy that she had to deal with, and she had a very short runway.
I do agree with that.
Okay, we're going to pause. We'll take a break. When we come back, we have a lot of letters. We'll get to those right after. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our program. We welcome you. I want to get to letters. Just a quick shout out. Today, the New York State Writers Institute is putting on a very cool event. They're going to be doing a marathon reading of William Kennedy's 1978 novel, Billy Fallon's Greatest Game. And William Kennedy, one of our great writers of this nation and of the world, who happens to live in this region, they're going to be reading this novel. They did this last year for Ironweed, and they're doing it this year for Billy Fallon's Greatest Game. It takes place at Albany Distilling Company. It goes from 11 in the morning until 10 in the afternoon. You can actually still sign up if you want to reserve a spot and read. I'm doing it in the 3 o'clock hour. Yeah, a bunch of friends got together and we're gonna do it. I did it last year. It was so much fun. Oh my God, it's so much fun. And so it's a great novel. It gave me an opportunity to read the novel again, which is just outstanding. And again, it's at Albany Distilling Company, Billy Fallon's Greatest Game, 11 to 10 today. And if you're looking for things to occupy your mind, what a great thing to do. NYSWritersInstitute.org for more information and to sign up for your spot if you want to read, or you can just sit down and listen. Again, NYSWritersInstitute.org.
Can I? What a great gift William Kennedy is to our area, and the gift he gave to our community, which is the New York State Writers Institute, and that grew out of his I call it the Genius Award, but I know they don't like that, not him, but the MacArthur Institute Award. And just a treasure for this area, and led by Paul Grondahl and his wonderful staff, and you know what a great resource to have in this area. So thanks to him for his generosity and
just the incredible things that they do, of just having writers like Edwige Dantecott last week and this event this week. Bill's 96 years old and
comes to the events.
Comes to many of the events, and you know, last time my son was doing well, I went over to his house and we drank Irish whiskey and we had a very nice time. Thank you very much. Just a fascinating individual and a really special. A very special thing indeed that we have in our backyard. All right, off to the letters we go. And Katie says, I think it's important to note how many people didn't vote compared to 2020. Even Trump hasn't necessarily gained votes overall yet. If we look at the 2020 election, it's where he gained the votes, though. It's where he gained the votes, and in the Georgia and Pennsylvania and places where he had gotten against Biden 33%, he was getting 43%. So he was gaining voters, and those votes, and in all the margins, everything got all boats lifted. So, which explains the win.
Right, but I do think that the writer has an interesting point that I think people will need to look at over time, which is certainly this is an election that got enormous attention, but it didn't it got a lot of new voters, but a lot of people didn't vote. And why didn't they vote? Did they not vote because, you know, sort of the bickering made them just, you know, forget it, I can't stand it, or because they have less faith in the electoral system because of the conversations they've been having? Or I think we do. I don't know the answer to why they didn't vote, but a significant number of people didn't vote, and I think it behooves us over time to understand that.
Right? 10 million.
Although voter turnout was up in so many areas.
Right.
Okay.
In so many categories. Young people.
Right.
But I do think that that's a piece of the puzzle that we need to over time have a better understanding.
I mean, I would argue that's always a piece of the puzzle. Right.
But why this time in with such intensity?
Yes.
And you did get this whole group of new voters come in, but was it 10 million?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I knew it was a big number. We need to understand why they didn't vote.
Right. And then the other thing is, you know, some of the mispredictions that were made. This is what I really think the Democratic Party look at. So, for example, all of the I'm going to use the word polling, but those people, since we're on radio, can't see I'm putting scare quotes around
right.
it. But all of the opinion analysis among younger people was leaning very heavily towards Harris. The actual voting returns showed a larger as best we can tell from the current exit polls, let's be very clear, looks like younger males went very heavily to Trump. The gender gap in the youth vote looks like it's going to be even higher than throughout the rest of the vote. That's, again, something
and the
different from what we've seen or what we've predicted or what we've thought. I think the Latina vote's another example where there was somewhere between a 25 and 30% difference between 2020 and 2024 and how they voted. And again, you know, that talking as if that's one voting block, that's a very complicated group. But that's 6% of the national electorate right there, given the current numbers. So, I mean, we really are looking at some stuff that's very complicated. In Pennsylvania, was 15,000 votes, right? Do the math on that, and you end up with, you know, Trump still winning, but by only 7 electoral votes, not looking like a landslide. I mean, it's, you know, it's a very complicated data situation out there, and I think trying to analyze what happened is going to be much harder than we think.
But essential. I think that the Latino vote was in some ways predicted the strength of it, the amount of it. I mean, because the Republicans had been working for a while on moving the Latino vote, which in some cases, again, not monolithic, but tends to be more conservative. But I think it was a stronger shift than was anticipated.
Well, stronger.
And we spent days and days and days and days in the media. I will say this show somewhat included, although I didn't like the story from the beginning, about the joke at the Madison Square Garden with the quote-unquote joke by the quote-unquote comedian. Well, he is a comedian. It's not quote-unquote.
Yeah.
Is that...
that was funny.
It is true. He is a comedian. Is that, you know, and we spent so much time talking about how horrible that was, and it was. However, there was a lot of other things mentioned at that rally that just didn't get the time. And then meanwhile, the big concern for the hand-wringing by many in the media was how is this going to affect the Latino vote? Well, it didn't.
Yeah. For me, the messaging around the joke was that, A, they knew, you know, they put that joke in the teleprompter. They put that script in the teleprompter. They made him take out some other stuff, so they were okay with that. They didn't apologize. But more importantly, it brought up a reminder of let's look back and see what his policies were more broadly, what he did during Hurricane Maria and his lack of response, his holding back funds, his throwing paper towels, or a whole range of other policy issues. So I think as a mechanism to bring out a policy discussion of, okay, is he on your side or not? Obviously, it didn't resonate as deeply as it might have with that community. But I
could argue that time could have been spent looking at other more important issues, like what was being said by the Speaker of the House and what was being said by the candidate himself.
Well, what was being said by, yeah, I mean, that whole rally was dark.
Right.
Misogynist.
Back to the letters. Linda, I think you're missing a very important factor in this discussion about why Trump won. Kamala Harris is black and Kamala Harris is a woman. And this country is still heavily racist and not really ready to have a woman. So that's an important issue that we should bring up, not just policies. People like to be entertained. They think when they're voting for president, it's like watching Netflix or other TV shows, and that worked in his favor. Lastly, there was so many lies that truth and lies are upside down in our country. We don't even know what the truth is. There's so many lies floating. And that's from Linda.
So I think that last part is very important. And, you know, this, Judy, is goes back to something you were saying, because we talk about mis and disinformation and things like that, but what we're really talking about is different coverage, right? You know, people keep talking about Fox News as if that's the right-wing station, right? I know a lot of people who consider Fox News to be a little more conservative than, you know, the mainstream media, but it's still part of the mainstream, right? When you start going out to News One, when you start going out to Truth Social, when you start going out to some of these things that are now going on Discord, on Slack, so outside of the traditional media, and then TikToks and things like that, you see some really different coverage of the exact same event, right? So let me not call that dis or misinformation. Let me call that presentation. And there's always been bias in the news, but I think that what's happened is there's so many news sources now. They're reporting things so differently that you really do have two very different medias in this country and not a spectrum. This, like so many other things in the country, we're seeing more more distinction, more adversarial. And that worries me, because that, Teresa, is my answer, is calling it disinformation or misinformation, sometimes, like, you know, the cats and, you know, Haitians eating your cats, are just plain wrong and lies. But some of them are things like, you know, I would watch the coverage of the same exact event on MSNBC, CNN, and Fox, and I'd swear they were three different events.
Absolutely.
And, you know, what can you do in that world? Because there's no, you know, people make their choice, and that's TV, which is watched by, you know, an age group that's very different. You go on to the TikToks, the Instagrams, things like that. Totally different sets of people. You can create your own news bubbles in ways that even Facebook, you know, won't let you do. So it really is a complicated thing that we're going to have to understand, I think, more in the distant future, because news isn't going to go back to you read your local paper. It's going to be you choose what you're reading from a very long set of possibilities, and I don't know how you solve that.
Yeah, but you need to look at this from both sides of the political spectrum, because, I mean, I will turn on to MSNBC and I would think to myself, can't you find a Republican to talk to? And I know they try. And I know CNN does a better job. And, you know, Fox does it to some extent. But the preponderance is you're inside a bubble, and you're not doing enough to discern what else is happening out in the media environment.
But as President Obama...
Can you
stop?
Do mine?
Oh, it's 10:01.
Yeah, it's 10:01.
Oh, my goodness.
With Ray starting to sweat, and he's getting all jittery and wants to get
I'm
into
sorry,
the
Ray.
Newscast. Yeah, you deal with it. We'll take a break, and we'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Thursday morning. And we are expecting the President of the United States, Joe Biden, to address the nation with the to talk about the election and to talk about the transfer of power, and we're expecting him to speak around 11 o'clock. We will bring that to you whenever it actually materializes, and we'll get to that. All right, let's go to some letters, and then we'll get to other topics. Kevin writes, the campaign has been going on for more than a year and a half. The people voted on everything, not just one or two issues. You need to give America more credit than you're giving them and stop crying about the results. David writes, I joined the seven-year-old in their tears. Our planet is on the brink of environmental collapse with the leader blind to this existential crisis. Jay writes, our current economy is the equivalent to a recession as experienced by people for whom terrible inflation has made their lives extremely difficult. The fact that union members would vote for Trump, even as their leaders endorsed Harris, gives us an insight into our current economy. As reflected in a recessionary consciousness, the risk of job loss or job competition from immigrants is the same kind of insecurity that makes people vote for a change agent like Donald Trump.
So, you know, this is the kind of argument that troubles me, because it seems so obviously true. But then, you know, the problem is your own life may be affected one way or the other. But when you look at the national trends, right, more people are working and they're making a higher wage increase than the current inflation increase. In other words, things are actually, in a certain sense, getting cheaper. Just doesn't feel like that. There's something called the gasoline effect, which is, you know, you drive past every station, it shows you what the cost is, and people will drive way out of their way to save 10 cents, not realizing that, you know, in filling a car with a 20-gallon tank, you're talking about $2. And you're probably driving an extra, you know, piece of thing. I mean, you know, so the problem is your day-to-day looking at what things cost isn't taking into account the big-ticket items, isn't hanging together. And I understand it. I mean, every time we go to the grocery store, I look at the bill and I'm like, thank God I can afford this. But at the same time, if I actually sat down with all the books and things like that, I think I'm better off. And I'm not the only one. And that's true across a lot of demographics that don't believe they're better off. Because, again, because of that feeling. At the end of the year, you know, your taxes and everything has been done, and, you know, there's $200 more in your bank. You don't feel like somehow that offset all of those extra costs. But, in fact, you've made $200 more. And that's part of, I think, what makes so much of this so hard. He's saying, you know, this has been going on for 18 months. But, in fact, people do make a lot of these decisions within the last days, and you know what things look like in those days, rather than these long term trends, make a lot of difference. And I don't know how you counter that, because they're very different kinds of things to look at.
I think what's interesting and complicated is to reinforce what you're saying is a lot of the economic indicators are better. Right. Inflation is down just above 2%, where it was way high. Right. And as you say, salaries are up, more people are working, so on and so forth. But grocery prices and housing are, you know, fundamentally too high for people. And that's what's on their minds. I think that Vice President Harris did try to message that. But that messaging was not heard, and Trump made it very simple. Interestingly enough, the previous writer about the climate issues.
Yes.
I think, again, this is where it gets really complicated, but the climate issue is integrated with the food price issue, right? I mean, olive oil, why is olive oil too high? Because of a climate issue. Why is chocolate too high? Because of a climate issue. And why is sunflower oil, which is fundamental to our cooking, so high? Because of what's going on in Ukraine. I mean, there's a lot of, there's still some supply chain issues. But one person wrote about, I read the other day, about this really, this trauma from the pandemic has really stuck with people.
Yes. I read that article.
It's really stuck with people. And even though there are better indicators, they're haunted by the reality of not having work, of, you know, not being able to pay the bills. And we need to speak to that more clearly.
And I do want to talk to one thing, is the immigrants taking our jobs. You know, there's one columnist who'll remain anonymous, who the two things I've read the most of his columns are, one, look at all these people who are leaving New York, right? We're losing population. And the other is, look at all these immigrants who are coming into New York to steal our jobs. And I'm sitting there going, like, get those immigrants to work. Get those immigrants paying taxes. New York State would have a higher number of people living here. We would get another representative, et cetera, et cetera. So there's this inconsistency in how people view this. And many of the jobs that are taken are jobs that are sitting unfilled. It's not like, oh, this person from another country came and stole my job doing X. It's that this person from another country came and took a job that I could have taken and didn't. And, you know, maybe because I'm making more in a different job. Maybe I'm making, you know, I don't have the skill set to go do that, or I'm not willing to be a nighttime, you know, out there on the road crew fixing the roads or some of the.
Or I don't have skills to be a programmer, as many of people.
Yeah.
But J.D. Vance, this is one of the things where, you know, I think we need to focus a lot more on the things he says and who he's, you know, who his circle of people that he's working with. But he turned about almost every single problem, he shifted it, blame shifted to illegal immigrants, including you know, not being able to get in to see a doctor, not being able to go to a hospital, not be able to get a job, you know, so on and so forth. And so, you know, I call it disinformation. Is it disinformation? Is it lies? Whatever. It's not accurate. It's misleading and it's troubling. And that's the kind of thing that bothers
me. But there is one thing, Joe, that if I could say to the readers, and if I could convince people this is true, because it is, it would make such a difference, right? we view this, quote, immigrant problem, and there are problems, but by and large, the people who come in are legal, still have a year to 18 months before they can have a job, right? If you could move people who are allowed to work into work faster, it would improve our economy. It would solve some of these problems. You'd have those people paying tax. You know, people are saying they're living in hotels using up my tax dollars. Well, how do we do that? Well, let them make money so they can move out of that hotel and rent a house. And
well, you know the first thing they're going to do is raid hotels. But you have a House and a Senate, may have a House, certainly have a Senate controlled by Republicans and the White House controlled by Republicans. How quickly do you think that they're going to pass a comprehensive immigration bill?
I would be surprised if you see it one.
Right. Because for more than 20, 30 years, there hasn't been an ability to reach consensus, even within among the Democrats, consensus among the Republicans, let alone between the two parties, on what a comprehensive immigration bill looks like.
And Trump had 4 years where the first two, he controlled both houses, and the only immigration policy put into place there was the family separation policy, which I think pretty much everyone now believes was a bad idea.
So immigration and the economy, core issues that people voted on, let's see what their solutions are. The solution to the economy is the tax breaks. Here, the Washington Post lead story, Trump poised to push tax plan with a hefty price tag. Remake the country's tax code. Major benefits will go to corporations and the upper class. That's his first thank you to all of those working class voters who came out in droves to support him.
Ellen writes to us, I know history doesn't repeat itself, but I think 2025 will be disturbingly like 1925. We'll experience complete financial collapse beginning 2029. This is the fault of both political parties, quote unquote. Thank you, Mr. and Mrs. Clinton, for getting rid of Glass-Steagall. Gotta keep those banks speculating with our deposits. Nice reference to Glass-Steagall, I think. Steve says, it doesn't matter how and why Trump won. It doesn't matter how long it will take for him to deconstruct democracy. On Election Day, Trump came back, and with him came the atmosphere of 1930s Germany. Suddenly, all open-minded people in the United States have become the Jews of 1930s Germany. Get ready for the worst that you can imagine. It's coming. Make your plans with that in your mind. Then we go to Jackie. We all on the left think that if we could just communicate our message better, those on the right who seemed so deluded and susceptible to disinformation would listen. But we can't talk our way out of this dilemma, because the hard truth is that our country, along with the rest of the world, has entered a game of high-stakes musical chairs, deadly pandemics, rapidly worsening global warming, a tsunami of desperate immigrants are hitting those at the bottom first and hardest. No wonder they respond to authoritarian rhetoric. Then we go to...
Joe, let me just say, I think that's a very important letter, and that thinking a lot of that stuff and how that could play out in the American political system in different ways would be, for those who are the political geeks and who are really thinking, you know, about a lot of this stuff and understand, you know, like Teresa does, that you know, when you talk about this department, you're talking really about 1,000 people, not the one person whose name you see.
So
rethinking a lot of how that's impacting people, re-understanding the notion that, you know, the Norquist notion that the government doesn't help me, you know, I don't want to destroy it, I just want to make it small enough so we can drown it in a bathtub. That thinking hasn't gone away.
So, Judy, on climate and migration, so the Trump administration, you know, believe what he says he's going to do. He's very clear that he doesn't believe in climate change. And he also, that's buoyed by the fact that he got an enormous amount of money from the oil and gas folks, right?
Yep.
And
as do Democrats.
I know, but he's in charge now. So
yes,
I'm just like,
understood.
So he got a lot of money from oil and gas folks. Mm-hmm. And he's been consistent for a long time, yep. Doesn't believe in climate change. But we all know that climate change will have an impact on immigration and on migration, migration patterns.
It already is. Okay.
And we also know that climate change has an impact on food, how we get our food and where we get our food from and where we can grow and how we grow food. And he has promised that in Project 2025 to wipe out any mention of climate change in the government, and to wipe out all those folks working on climate change, and to defund all of the Inflation Reduction Act funding to try to drive clean energy. And so given how do you prepare a country for addressing these issues of access to food and migration issues, when you won't, when if he does what he says he's going to do, you're not going to have a focus on the root cause, a core root cause of
and
both of these issues.
And it's going to take a long time.
Right. So how do you? So what happens?
To, so
how,
what are you expecting from me at this point?
No, but if that's...
Solve it.
No, what I'm saying...
Come on, Judy.
But you were talking about how you can't label this stuff as disinformation. I'm just... So how do you get at these issues that are very important in the lives of the American people?
All right, let's deal with a common... I don't know whether it's a trope or not, but, I mean, there's very strong far-right opposition to electric vehicles. And people will argue that, well, you know, when you charge up your electric vehicle, you're charging it through a coal-fired plant. How do you get past that? I mean, that's a real logical issue. I mean, let's really talk about that rather than just dismiss people who don't like electric vehicles.
So,
I mean,
so this
it's a
is
real
how,
issue.
This is how you get past that. You have deep investments in research on battery storage, and where is that funding for those deep investments? It's in the Inflation Reduction Act, which he has promised he's going to stop all that funding. So the research to try to figure out where is new battery storage, how do you secure the electric grid, that's all tucked into the Inflation Reduction Act, which improves jobs and research and stuff. So that's going to go away under his plan.
No. Trump has completely changed his opinion of electronic vehicles. It's pure coincidence that Elon Musk gave more money to Trump than just about anyone else.
But my point here is that this is a real discussion. This is something that's not totally off the charts for people who are really are skeptical of electric vehicles to raise. And trust me, the capitalism has tried to deal with this issue of battery development for years. I mean, GE over in Schenectady used to do this. I mean, 10, 15 years ago, we would write stories about their efforts to develop large batteries that would serve populations in Africa, for example. So this is not something that can just be linked to the Inflation Adjustment or Reduction Act. I mean, this is something that will go forward. But again, my point
here... But how will it go forward if he says he doesn't believe in climate change? So how do you get at these... How do you solve these problems for the American people if you don't believe in climate change and you want to disinvest in NOAA, you want to privatize NOAA, so on and so forth? That's what I'm trying to figure out.
And that's the political side of it. Let me... Are you back from the
science?
No,
it's the policy side.
But I was going to say, but let me...
I feel like I'm getting beat up here.
I'm not trying to...
Joe agrees.
You're playing a stalking
horse. I'm not trying to beat you up. I'm really trying to say, okay, so how do you fix these problems? So, that's really a question. How do you fix them?
So, Judy, just for example, you just talked about electronic vehicles.
Electronic vehicle, by the way.
We'll have to be powered by these things, and that's a real concern, and we should be addressing it. Answer is, I can show you stacks and stacks of technical papers that show exactly what those trade-offs are and why this saves it, not to mention that the issue has a lot to do with where emissions happen and things like that. Problem is, how do you get somebody to sit down? I mean... It literally would take me a month to go through the pile of papers on my desk that address this, and I'm supposedly expert in this, right? Imagine trying, you know, the problem is these things don't have easy explanations, right? People are constantly asking me about the cost of AI and things like that, and I'm like, you know, you've got Microsoft buying Three Mile Island so they can power this stuff, and you've, you know, it's clearly eating a lot of
The explanation power. Isn't that just... electric vehicles are good and being against electric vehicles is bad. The answer is we need a real discussion of it. We need journalism to talk about it. We need conversations about it out in the community. It's just not black and white. And I think that's the point I've been trying to make here today. Things aren't black and white. I mean, everything Trump proposes isn't bad. And you need to recognize, we need to recognize that.
Well, no, what I really ask, and I didn't mean to, if I sounded like I was, what I'm trying to have a conversation about, okay, so if you have an administration that doesn't believe in climate change, but in fact, that's at the root of some of the core issues, immigration, economy, that are most troubling to people, which they voted on, then how do you get to solutions? What's the pathway to solutions on those things? I'm not saying that you're wrong. I'm saying how do you, in this environment, it's really a question, not a leading question. You know, like, in this environment, how do you then get to address those things which are the problems that people are most angst about?
I mean, I think immigration has been an issue for our country for 100, 200 years.
Yep.
I mean, and we've never really come up with a reasonable solution for any group of people who are trying to come to our country, build our country up, make it better. I mean, we're all descendants of immigrants, I'm pretty sure. Whether Congress, it's a political football. Congress doesn't want to deal directly with it. But saying that, but it's something very clearly that the American public wants addressed.
Right.
And the idea that, well, clearly, the American people don't understand that this deals with climate. It has an effect on climate. Well, maybe we need to do a better job of trying to explain those issues. But I think maybe it's a matter of degree. Maybe people do accept the notion that people should be able to cross that southern border, but not as many as have. Maybe they're willing to accept a certain amount of that. Maybe people believe that only people with, you know, PhDs need to be able to be immigrants. Maybe some farmers believe that people who want to be laborers need to be immigrants. But again, it's a matter of degree, not of black and white.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. Last go round, we'll have another half hour of conversation with our group. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. ORG, and we'll return right after this break and then news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Thursday morning, the 7th. We'll be going to 11 o'clock. We are expecting the President of the United States, Joe Biden, to speak to the nation about the election and the transfer of power. That is expected at 11 or soon after. We'll be covering that whenever it does happen. All right, let's go to some letters. I'll get to as many as I can here, and then we'll move on to other topics. Let us begin with Jay. Those who are complaining about the cost of food and also calling for illegal aliens to be deported, who is going to bring you cheap food if farmers can't find laborers? Colleen writes, the last 8 years have pointed out to me the intense misogyny of the nation. Trump won both elections when he ran against women, only losing when he ran against a man. I think the fear of being governed by a woman, even by women, was greater than the fear of being governed by the multi-flawed Trump. Then
I just want to say hallelujah to that, because we really, really saw, again, still all based on exit polling, but the male-female divide in this election, very, very high, even higher than it was in the Clinton one. But that was sort of the second highest of the past many elections. So, you know, we really do see an effect at the national level. What's interesting is at local levels, we're seeing some very big changes. There were two black women elected to Congress this year. To the Senate.
I also want to applaud Vice President Harris. I know a lot of people disagree with me, and people shouted me down yesterday when I said we need to think about the gender issues in this race. It's not only because of gender, but I think it was a factor. But applaud Vice President Harris. I thought she ran a really stellar campaign. It's amazing what she accomplished in a short amount of time and her message discipline. And And so cheers to her for that.
David said, I attended the live roundtable yesterday. Thank you for doing that. I know it was not easy. I appreciated the efforts by the panelists trying to put some perspective on this election and the fact that Democrats need to examine carefully its disconnect with those who moved to supporting Trump. All of that is very true. What I found difficult about yesterday is that I just found myself in a very difficult place to hear that. The wounds are fresh. They're raw. I'm scared. I know we need to work hard to reconnect with those who voted for Trump. My deep fear is that there is not enough time. Climate warming is marching on, and 4 years is a long time, leading to a place where there is no room for recovery. The conflicted state of the world is in a very fragile place. Urgency seems the unavoidable issue here, leaving one feeling lost and very confused. Then we go to Deb, who says, we've got to start talking to the other side. I know in my heart that Kamala and the Dems fumbled that big time.
Whoa, wait a minute.
But how?
All right, hold on. Ann says, I have to disagree that we just need to talk to our neighbors who voted for Trump, that they are just trying to live life. I have a lot of MAGA friends and coworkers. I'm shocked by the hatred they freely give. It is hard to be with them when hate is their guide and not followed, and not allowed by the Republican Party.
One of the things that I was most, proud of, encouraged by with Vice President Harris is her discipline in reaching out to all sides, and she kept talking about the importance of building community. She kept talking in ways to try to lower the temperature, decrease the hate, and I think that that needs to be acknowledged. The other side was they use hate and fear as an organizing tool, and I think that she, more so than anyone else I've seen in a long time, tried to counter that. So I disagree with those who said that she didn't.
All right, let's go back. Andrew says, I just paid $2.80 a gallon for gas. Should I thank Biden or Trump? Then we go to...
I just want to know where he bought the gas.
Yeah, let's go. Ken says, am I alone in thinking that the spirit of the 60s, the spirit of community caring and giving, finally died on Tuesday, or am I just old? Bill says, dear panel, don't search through the data. The Democrats lost for two reasons. Folks want a strong man over a woman. Folks do not want woke ideology pushed down their throats, i.e. trans rights, climate change, LGBTQIA+ issues. These two factors explain as much as the Biden-Harris failure on immigration, inflation, and the confused Mideast policies.
I'm going to question that one on LGBT, et cetera. I do believe there is a backlash there. I do believe that motivated a lot of evangelicals to come out. But right now, virtually all polling on a national level, and again, that gets us back to the Electoral College issue, but almost all polling on a national level is starting to at least even out, if not go in favor. So, for example, repealing gay marriage is now an amazingly small percent of people who are in favor of that compared to where you would have been 20 years ago. Trans is starting to come up. I believe we just had the first trans woman elected to the Senate.
Correct.
So you really are seeing that attitudes in those spaces changed and changed quickly, and that's been a generational shift. And I think some of these other things will also be generational shifts. The problem is generational shifts take generations, and some of the problems we're facing, and this is what the people on the radio are saying. It takes a long time.
On that topic, John says, once again, you're not listening to the warnings from us, the LGBTQ+ community. Please do not tell me how I need to reach a handout to people who want me dead. And make no mistake, there will be rounding people like me and Libby up by the end of the decade. I do not expect to be alive to see 2030 now. People voted for Trump because they hate trans people, who they all think are trans women, who they think are gays in a dress, because they'll never stop hating gay men like me. They continue to demonize gay men. They've been doing it to grab power. They did it in the 90s. They never stopped. And they're coming for the rest of you when they're done with us. You can feel the passion in a letter like that. Then we go to Jeff.
I would like to... I feel like I'm jumping in way too much, but the problem is I've been paying too much attention to this stuff. They are being addressed to some degree, and in some places, the way Germany addressed the Jews in the 30s and 40s. But the part that's different is we are in a federal situation where modulo some major legal change at the federal level, which is not impossible if you end up with the Republicans having all three houses. But, you know, New York just voted to protect your rights in that respect. Other states have. Most of the anti-abortion measures failed. The one in Florida passed, or depending how you look at it, the vote didn't change the Florida rules, but 57% of Floridians voted in favor of getting rid of the abortion ban. It's just that their legislation had made it 60% that had to do it to get the change. So, you know, I think he's right that people want to scapegoat someone. I think trans is the new scapegoat. I think gay is a little less than it was, but I certainly would be worried. You know, it's a scary time, and particularly with this Supreme Court, it's a scary time.
This palpable fear was stoked by millions and millions of dollars invested in Trump campaign ads and related groups' campaign ads that stoked this fear. This fear was not stoked from those ads didn't rise out in opposition to a policy position that the vice president took. This was a demonization to try to drive this fear. And what do you do to make people not afraid? I mean, this is not a trans issue, but I talked to a person at a cash register the other day, and he was Puerto Rican. And he is terrified that they're going to come for him. He's legal, but how does he prove that? The headline right now in the Washington Post, the Haitians of Springfield brace for Trump presidency. Deep fear in that community. How do you deal with these genuine fears that people have on both sides? The economic fears that didn't get spoken to and the fears that got generated because of this using wedge issues, using hate as an organizing tool to gain power.
Let's go to James, who said, I like this letter. I think it's a good
important letter.
It's a good letter. James writes, one of the most difficult things about the election is that we in the blue states are now the minority, that we have here at WAMC as our own little bubble. It may be a bubble of truth, but it is still a marginalized bubble. The problem now with talking to Trump supporters is that they now feel that we are the ones who need to be convinced to join them. We are the ones who they have been made to think are crazy, and there's no longer any way to convince them otherwise. That is the difference between this election and 2016, where at very least you could say, well, Hillary won the popular vote. The majority of the people are behind this particular ideology, which in this case is not true.
Well, I mean, what comes to mind right now in my head is probably not well thought out, but I'm not going to switch over to the side that called up people to go and attack the Capitol and in so doing attack the core of our democracy and deeply injured 140 police officers. And, you know, I'm going to do it. I'm on the side of, and I'm not saying that all of those people that voted for him voted, you know, or would do that or support that. But I think that there's some core things underlying this that drove. Let me go back. I think one thing that President Obama said that always resonated with me is, if I watched Fox News, I wouldn't vote for me either, which is a broad way of saying that this repetition of this stuff is effective. And I was just pointing
to a headline that says that Steve Bannon has floated Marjorie Taylor Greene for Homeland Security
policy. And I just happened to see the last few words of that, which Marjorie Taylor Greene for Homeland Security, and I know he's supposed to announce some people today, and I thought that was an announcement, and I was about to lose my mind.
It's a suggestion.
But I think this fomenting hate...
It's a wish list.
A fomenting hate is a strategy, and it's a strategy that was proved effective, and I think that's a problem for our country.
All right, let's go to Jeff. Isn't it ironic that only a few months ago most pundits were saying that Trump would destroy the GOP for generations, if not forever? Now it looks like Trump has indeed saved the party, and the GOP will perhaps be strong for years to come. And it pains me to say this, but Democrats will not nominate a woman for president again in my lifetime. Then Kurt says, WAMC has now been completely 100% proven to be out of touch with the American voter, totally 100% proven in red that your outlandish left-wing thinking is nowhere near what the American people thinks or wants. Sad day to be a New Yorker, but what a great day to be an American.
I would simply point out to that person that if you look at the electoral map, and if you look at the six states we cover, and you look at what color they look on the map, we represent a piece of the country. And yes, I do think we need to widen our understanding of these things and have some of these conversations on air. I know Joe kills to try to get people to come in here. We've had Faso and people.
Yeah, not
like that.
Literally kill, but.
Well, yeah. Right. If he killed, they wouldn't be on the air. But Joe tries very, very hard.
Be very careful of our words these days.
I know.
I think it's important to understand that it's hard to find people who want to stand up for that position in this part of the country. If we were an Arkansas public radio station, we'd have a very, very different slant, and people would be writing in saying, you guys are so out of touch.
But I appreciate the letter. I mean, I think it's an important perspective.
Yeah.
All right. I want to take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up for this Thursday morning, and we will wait the president, Joe Biden, who is expected to speak in about within the next hour. We'll take a break. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Thursday morning. Jim Henler, Judy Patrick, and Teresa Bourgeois making up our group. And I thank you all for being with us. So just a few minutes, and I want to just get to this one story, too. As Trump wins the White House, special counsel is now weighing how to end trials. Jack Smith could wind down two federal prosecutors of the former and future president and submit a report to Attorney General Merrick Garland. As Donald Trump clinched his resounding presidential victory on Wednesday, the four criminal cases against him seemed to begin their march to dissolution. The election win prompted special counsel Jack Smith to start discussing how to wind down the two federal prosecutions of the president-elect, according to a person familiar with the internal deliberations who spoke on the condition of anonymity. One case accuses Trump of hoarding highly classified documents after leaving the White House. The other charges him with trying to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election. Judy.
So I think the one thing that might happen here is Jack Smith might issue a report by the time the Biden administration ends. I think that's the people who want Donald Trump to be held accountable for these things. I think that's the best they can hope for at this point. Again, I think Jack Smith's office or the Attorney General's office would like clarification of what the Florida decision that the special prosecutor really, that office doesn't have the authority to do what it was trying to do. I think that probably needs to be resolved once and for all. But am I losing sleep over the fact that Donald Trump is not going to go to jail for any of these things? No, because I never thought it was going to happen. happen in the first place.
What I do think is going to be interesting is what happens in the New York case, because that's not federal. There is the question of how the Supreme Court decision affected that. However, it's already been ruled that not all of the evidence is thrown out, which meant not all of the convictions will be overturned. My guess that any major thing is going to come out of that. You know, you're not going to throw the president-elect in jail. Even a suspended sentence, which is what I thought might be possible if he lost the election and was still appealing things. But I think what you will see is some kind of probationary or, you know, there'll be a wrist slap at least. There'll be something that says he was guilty and, you know, we do not believe that just because he was a former president, he can't be prosecuted in New York. But, you know, a lot of people claim that that's what turned the election around. So I don't know. But, you know, I mean, this is, again, the problem is when you go with the legal rules and people say, well, that makes us a banana republic because we're charging someone just for political reasons, despite the fact that jury found him guilty. I mean, you know, it's a hard space to be in. But I do think something will stay on his record there. The other one that I found amusing but unfortunate is because the case, the rape case, was a civil trial. Right. The current law in Washington, D.C. is if you're convicted of a crime, of a sex crime, you go on an offenders list with your address. But it's not for civil, which is too bad, because otherwise the White House would be listed as the home of a sex offender, which would be a very strange situation.
I do think there needs to be some discussion about the classified documents case, because I'm sure, you know, he succeeded in doing what he wanted to do, which is delay, and, you know, use campaign donations to fund his legal cases here and delay until he gets back into the White House, which protects him from being held accountable. But there's some real serious implications around the classified documents case as a precedent. So now how do you hold other people accountable for the mishandling of classified documents, because you now have this case where he has not been held accountable? And what does that do to the ability of gathering information and of people being afraid or not being afraid of being sources? What are the long-term and wide implications of no accountability on the way he handled classified documents? And I know everyone will say, well, what about Biden? What about everybody else? I think it's what President Biden did and what some other Republicans and Democrats have done with cases is basically, it looks like they took him out of the office, kept him in boxes in their garage unknowingly. When they went back through, they had stuff that they had and gave it back as soon as they found out that they had it. That's a very different scenario than how former President Trump handled classified documents. And I think it raises some very deeply concerning precedents.
Anyone else on that?
No, it was clear that he shouldn't have done this. And maybe they need to really look at the procedures for handling classified documents, where even he has to go into a SCIF, you know, one of those secure facilities, to look at documents, and he can't take copies of it. You know, when this story initially broke, there was some concern that he was going to use it as leverage, or he was going to try to sell these documents, or he was going to do something nefarious with them. I mean, I don't think that has ever developed as a story or as a case, but we don't know, because the case kind of got stopped.
Well, there was a recording where we know he showed them to people.
Right, he showed them to people, but he wasn't trying to sell them. He was just trying to, I think he was, and in those cases, he was using it kind of just to brag that I've got them, or to help with a book project, I think it was.
No, Biden was, maybe so. I know Biden issue, he took notes of classified documents. So with Biden, the question was, he understood that having notes that were based on classified documents were okay, but it turns out they said maybe not, because there had been precedent in the past where that had been allowed. But there was a question. Anyway.
All right.
we're out of time. My thanks to everybody for being here, and thank you for playing the home game. We enjoy having you here. We're going to let Judy go to the media project, which looks like it's getting ready to start taping, so I don't want you to be late for that. My thanks to Jim Henler and to Teresa Bourgeois. Judy, have fun over in the other studio.
And Joe, I just want to make it clear. Teresa and I were not trying to beat up on Judy.
I feel so badly about that.
We were just as frustrated as she is.
I was trying to generate a discussion. I wasn't trying to attack you. I'm sorry.
We all love each other. Goodbye.
We do.
We'll be back.